Welcome to the author commentary for Star Wars, From a Certain Point of View, The Empire Strikes Back. Here, we go behind the scenes with contributors to discuss the creative process behind their stories. A word of caution, these conversations may contain story spoilers. I'm Tom Holler, one of the Del Rey editors who worked on this project. Right now, we're talking to Catherine Valenti, author of a story called This Is No Cave. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm so happy to be here. This is so exciting.
This is especially exciting because you chose one of the most amazing POVs, the Space Slug, the Exegorth. So right off the bat, tell us, what made you choose the big boy hiding in the asteroid?
Well, when I first was asked to contribute, I was just overwhelmed and excited. And I watched Empire Strikes Back for the zillionth time and kind of took notes on characters I might be interested in. But I think it was probably inevitable. A lot of my own work, I tell from a monstrous point of view or from a interestingly inhuman point of view. So I knew I kind of wanted to do something alien, but there are actually not nearly as many aliens in Empire as there are in episode one and in episode three. And one of my very favorite Star Wars books that I read when I was younger was Tales from the Mos Eisley Cantina. And I loved all of the really wild points of view of these aliens. So I knew I was looking for something not quite human, even though my instinctual first idea was Lobot. But I figured everybody would want Mr. Headphones. So I wanted to do something different. But when I do feel like it was inevitable, because when I told my family when this was all announced, and I, you know, in the group chat was like, I'm doing this Star Wars thing. They're all like, oh, let us guess what you picked. And my brother was like, yeah, she's doing the Yeti or the Slug. It's one or the other. It's like, I am indeed doing the Slug. I was always fascinated by that scene as a kid. It's really, when you're a child and there's that pullback of the camera and you see that, this has never been what you thought it was. It's such a little moment of perspective that doesn't come along all that often in movies. And I loved it. And I also knew that once I sort of had the idea, I knew I could make people love that slug. And I thought, you know what? If I do this right, anyone who's read this story will never see that scene the same way again.
It's true, and we're gonna get into why that is, and I'd love to start kind of to dig into a little bit of not exactly what transpires just yet, that we'll get to it, but how you went about doing that, because when you read the story, the writing feels just like completely ethereal, and it's like unbelievably beautiful, and so how did you go about figuring out like what the actual tone and writing style and sort of for, you know, voice of a giant space worm was going to be, because it's a story about a giant space worm, but it becomes a treatise on memory and love and time and rebirth. So how did you find that angle? How did you find like, this is what the space slug should sound like?
Well, I mean, it's kind of my gig, like that whole thing is sort of my aesthetic. So I knew that, I was going to do something like that, but I also wanted to make sure that the language was very controlled, because this is a Star Wars anthology. This is not an anthology of modernist poetry. And I still wanted it to be an exciting story, an adventure story. I wanted it to sort of be a little peek into the vast world of Star Wars. So to have that moment you see on screen where suddenly everything is so much bigger than you thought over again. But the bigness is truly vast, billions of years. And so if I'm going to do that, I have a truly alien consciousness here. This thing doesn't even have eyes. Who knows what its anatomy is? It is beyond the ken of even the aliens in the cantina and most of anything that we see in Star Wars. And I knew that I was going to have to find a way to have language that was still accessible, but felt alien. So I took away gender first. And then there's little bits in parentheses and in italics that are sort of offbeat English in order to sort of communicate that it's the way that it perceives things is not the way that we perceive things. And because it swallows all this stuff, taste is a big deal, and its internal senses are as intense as our external senses are. And when you're looking at something that lives in space like that, I mean, human lifespans don't mean anything at all to something like that. And so I knew that I was going to have to deal with memory and how it conceived of itself. And just answering those questions constructs a pretty interesting linguistic puzzle. You know, just figuring all of those things out anatomically, even answering the question of is it living in the asteroid, or is the asteroid like a snail shell? Even answering that question, you know, opens up notions of what this creature truly is.
Yeah, it's really incredible. We talk about, and we talked about it with some of the other authors who are also writing stories from creatures' point of views, or even, you know, Tracy Young writing about like the actual cave on Dagobah, this idea of how do you write from the perspective of a being that just does not interact with, engage with, or interpret the world around us the way humanoid characters do. And in your case, not only did you have all of these great ways of recontextualizing everything from sense to meaning to how we interpret things, but you also told a story that takes place over the course of billions of years. Like you actually just stretched the timeline out beyond really anything that you could read pretty much in Star Wars. And I think that actually just contributed to this even greater sense of other and of different. Because it's like, yeah, we've met characters like Yoda, he's 900 years old. So, okay, he's long lived. But like you have stretched this out just to like the beginning and end of the universe, which I think really contributed to that. But to bring it to a little more, I was going to say down to earth, but that doesn't make sense. To bring it to a little more focused decision that you make, which was really intriguing, was like, you make Exegorth society and you sort of made them, turn them into collectors. So like, where did that part of developing these creatures come from? And this is, I mean, I could say this pretty much at any point in this interview, like how the heck did you make us feel so sorry and so empathetic for a giant space slug?
Well, as far as the collector thing, like that came so naturally to my mind, because if you look, if you watch that scene, it's just, it is such a strange thing. It's not like Han is some kind of newbie in space, and it doesn't even occur to him that this is other than an asteroid or cave until things start really getting real. And so how big must the inside be that that's not a thing? It must have pressurization. It must have an atmosphere, because they walk around in it. They have the masks on, but they don't have a suit on. So they're this is a pressurized place that has some kind of atmosphere enough to support other creatures that are in there. And so if you just take that and expand it, well, maybe other of the Exegorths have different flora and fauna living in them. And then you give them a little agency, and maybe they got that flora and fauna on purpose. You give it a little culture, and maybe what you have inside you is a deterministic thing in their universe. It means something about you. And so we sort of arrive at where Sayo comes in. But as far as like how to feel for it, I mean, there are cheats. Like, it's a baby, for one thing. you know, it's a billion years old, but it's a baby. Yeah. And it's completely rejected by its culture. And listen, all of us know what rejection feels like. All of us know how it is to see everyone else having this togetherness and this belongingness that you want and can't access. And I think a lot of us who grew up loving Star Wars before it was as ubiquitously loved now, you know, growing up in the 80s and being a Star Wars nerd, like there are a lot of us reading this book who piercingly know what that feels like. And so the suffering that Sayo has, like it's longing to not just belong, but to have something that belongs to it, is ironically a very human thing, a very human impulse. And so once you've kind of heard it in plain view of everybody, it's a lot easier to get people to feel strongly for it. But then also, I'm leaning heavily on what people know about Han and Leia and C-3PO and Chewie and everything that's going on inside it.
Yeah, well, that's a perfect segue, because we spend this time with Sayo, which I also want you to actually give a little explanation of like what inspired that name, because it's just such an interesting name. And when you think about it, like, well, what would I name the space slug? And then that naturally leads to the question of how would the space slug have decided to name itself that? Or if another being named the space slug, how do we get Sayo? So actually, let's start there. I do want to ask about Han and Leia.
Yeah.
Where did the name come from? Where is the name inspired by? It's S-Y-O for anyone who hasn't seen it in text yet.
Again, I knew I really wanted something alien, but not something so alien, not like, you know, Elon Musk kid's name or something, like something that people could actually pronounce. So I started kind of trying to conceptualize what that would be. And I came across, so SI-O is the chemical abbreviation for silicon, which is what an exogorth is made of. But there is already a CO, there's CO Bibble already. Yes. So I just kind of altered it so that I could keep the association with chemistry and silicon and the hyphen, and then the second capitalized letter, all of which communicates a very non-standard naming nomenclature.
Yeah, it's very Star Wars also, like lots of hyphens and multiple capitalizations. Yeah.
So I was pretty, and I wanted it to be short because, you know, it's more endearing to have a short name than a long, complex name. And I knew that I wanted people to, it's quite a short story. I had a short period of time to get people to fall in love with this thing. So I wanted to have a short name that people felt like they might actually call somebody that they cared about.
It's really effective. So you mentioned like one of the key parts of the story is we actually get to see some very iconic Han and Leia interactions and scenes from a truly sort of outsider unique perspective. So how was it like adapting these, you know, absolutely iconic, super well-known scenes, but doing it through these other senses, or the recontextualization that Sayo does through their senses of their kiss and their holding the hands and Leia glowing because she's luminous, literally, which is amazing.
I made myself cry.
Everyone in the office cried too. That's going on the record. So.
I mean, it was such a combination of changing that perspective allowed me to strip all the proper names out. Because of course, you know, Sayo's not going to know their names. They're kind of psychic space slugs, but psychic with each other. The operating system doesn't jive with Windows. Taking the proper names out and just being able to deal with them as archetypes that I can absolutely trust. Everybody picking up this book is going to pick up what I'm putting down. Allowed me to really look at it from a deeply emotional place, but at the same time, also, my God, I can't express to you how much I spent my childhood worshiping Leia, and to even get to like put a word next to her, I'm going to cry now. Like, it's such an honor, and you know, there are a few points in there where I was thinking so much of Carrie Fisher, luminous being as she is. And I was thinking, there's a line that sort of even references Kylo Ren and all of the tragedy that is to come and how much this space slug just wants to save them from it. The way we all want to save any character in a tragedy. From what we know is going to happen to them. And so it was really emotional for me to write and to find ways to shorthand these beloved characters without using their names. And then to just pepper in the words from a scene that, I mean, good Lord, most of us have memorized.
Exactly.
That was my favorite part of writing. And it just flowed out and I was a mess.
It just is. And it is one of those things where even if you just gave someone like those two pages out of context of its own short story, people so know those scenes and you so effectively distill them into their just pure emotional component parts that people are like, oh, this is the Han and Leia scene. It's written a little weird, but this is that Han and Leia scene when they're in the asteroid that's not an asteroid. And that there's a line somewhere you describe Han man with a mocking voice is I think how you describe Han. It's just like, that is the perfect way to describe Han Solo without using the words Han and Solo. And there's no way that anyone who has ever even heard of Star Wars is not going to be like, oh, that's Han Solo you're talking about. It's great. And it is, it's devastating, particularly because like you actually find yourself, you're like, I know they have to leave because they've got to save the galaxy, but like, yeah, just stay. It's nicer there. Like, it's just stay, be as one together.
That was my goal. That was my secret goal. Like, I just want one person to watch that scene again and go, no, come back.
it's well done. And a big part of it is this, this sense of an understanding of a thing like the Force and the Force. But again, as we've been talking about, through a completely different perspective that doesn't relate to it the same way. So I want to kind of wrap things up by having you just talk a little bit about the idea of the Road of All Moons and the concept behind that. And how do you see it existing either as part of or alongside the idea of Force in Star Wars?
So for Exegorath, the Road of All Moons describes their kind of life cycle, which, as we've said, is billions of years long, where they are moving through space toward and away from the galactic core. But like anything that is just a physiological aspect of life, it becomes deeply mythologized and part of their culture, so that this is the great circle of life. It is the circuit of life, that everyone is caught in this pattern, and that flow, both of physical travel, but also traveling through the history of other creatures, and knowing that, you know, a human lifespan is virtually nothing to them, and that's sort of part of the tragedy too, that Sayo doesn't understand their story because it cannot conceive of something so short. But I think of the relationship between the Road of All Moons and the Force as the Force is like a current and an eddy that they follow. Because there's a passage where it talks about its travels, and it, without ever naming names or getting specific about anything, it tends to flow toward Force heavy events. Which is not necessarily something I would expect readers to pick up on a first read, but it's there, that it seems to be drawn towards these, you know, wars and happenings where there are a lot of Force users. I conceive that it can sense that and moves toward it, not in a food type way, but just that the Force is the current of life, and so is this road. So the Road of All Moons is not synonymous with the Force, but it's parallel with the Force. And then Sayo's kind of revelation, its own revelation at the end, that they will all meet again, because everyone, no matter what happens to you, is still on the same course, that it cannot be avoided. And that one day in its mind, it will join with these people that it experienced once again. That very much is the Force. And without ever using that word again, like I kind of made it hard for myself by removing the ability to use all of the famous Star Wars words.
I'm gonna write a Star Wars story, but I'm not going to use any of the Star Wars words.
Yeah, I'm not going to say the Force, not going to say Han, not going to say Leia, not going to say any of it. So without using that word, to contextualize that concept in a new culture. And I think one of the brilliant thing about this anthology series is that it makes you see the story in a different way. And I think that actually stripping all of those identifiers out, but still having the story be what it is another way to sort of kick the brain into seeing things differently. Because you go into a certain narrative headspace when you hear these familiar Star Wars words, and you have certain expectations of that. And by just taking a step away from it, and removing the ability to just sort of trigger those things, the reader is put into a different position.
Well, despite all of the challenges you laid before yourself regarding not using the Star Wars words, despite all of those kind of extra hurdles and things you constructed, it's an absolutely amazing story. And we're not kidding. You are going to get so emotionally attached and emotional about a story about the Exegorth, the space slug, and it's just it's unbelievable. And you're not going to be able to watch. This is one of the favorite things about doing these stories. You're not going to be able to watch that scene and those scenes inside the cave that is not a cave the same way ever again after you read this story. And so thank you so much for writing it, and thank you for coming on today to tell us about it and tell us about how you constructed it.
Thank you so much for letting me be a part of something I have loved my whole life.
It is our great pleasure. And thank you all for listening. You can read This Is No Cave and all the other stories in From a Certain Point of View, The Empire Strikes Back, which is available right now from all your favorite booksellers in print, ebook, and audio download. Thank you so much, and may the Force be with you.